Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An artist's point in time and culture matters. Caravaggio came after Michelangelo and had to find his own way. Frank Stella came after Jackson Pollock and the great abstract expressionists. He went even more abstract, essential, minimalist, then let his art roam for half a century. He's still creating our visual future. This hour on Point, American great Frank Stella on the edge of art and the evolution of art. You can join the conversation. Were you there for the abstract heyday of Jackson Pollock, of Jasper Johns, of Frank Stella? Did it excite you and the world around you? Where's art going now in our age of visual superabundance? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is celebrated painter, printmaker, and sculptor Frank Stella. He zoomed to prominence young in the 60s with his minimalist abstract paintings. At 75, he's still actively creating. He was awarded the National Medal of Arts by President Obama in 2009, influenced by the likes of Jackson Pollock and Jasper Johns and Caravaggio, a major influence in turn on the architect Frank Gehry and several generations of painters. His irregular polygons work from the 1960s is currently on show at Toledo's Ohio's Museum of Art. He is also showing at the National Gallery in Berlin and starting in June at the Phillips Collection in Washington. Frank Stella in New York, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
It's great to be with you. Thinking about your work and the course of your work, the work before and maybe after, but here we are now in this age when everywhere you turn, you find screens and images and visual creation all around us. I'm curious how that changes, or if it changes, the challenge to an artist to create some visual sensation that's significant.
Well, I'm not so sure that, you know, that the problem changes that much. And I like your idea in the beginning about the edge of art, because it reminded me of to get out of art for just a moment, what Mario Andretti, the famous American race driver, said, you know, if everything is under control, you're not going fast enough. And so that's the way it is in a way with the visual activity that surrounds you. You have to make your way through it.
What I guess that to kind of circle back even on that, when there's so much around you, how do you cut through it? How do you take it out of control, to stick with Mario Andretti for a second there, when, you know, there's a video game produced every 20 seconds and a new digital image every millisecond? And, you know, how does the artist get out in front of all that these days?
Well, it's an interesting question, really. But I suppose that for me and for a lot of artists anyway, it's really a question, finally, of the surface that you work on. And if it's a surface that's unyielding, you produce an image and you have the material. So it's a question of surface and material and something that's physically there. If you're dealing with images that are on the screen or backlit or on television, those are images, but they are, mm-hmm. how different they are from what art has traditionally been, which has been the making of marks on surfaces. We can go back to Lascaux, to Chauvet, and we can continue on through the Renaissance, through frescoes, and all through 20th century painting anyway.
I'm glad you mentioned Lascaux and the cave paintings in southern France. I mean, then, if you think about it, in the human experience, to see anything representational or just graphic, I suppose, painted even just on a cave wall, was surely a big deal.
Well, it's an interesting big deal because there are the paintings at Lascaux and there are the paintings at Chauvet nearby, mm-hmm. and there's a big discussion about the dating of the paintings, because Chauvet paintings, which look very much like the paintings at Lascaux, could be as much as 10,000 to 30,000 years before the paintings at Lascaux, which would mean that people painted more or less the same way for 30,000 years, which is a little different from our idea about how quickly art should change or what new would be.
Werner Herzog's got his new movie out about that takes us back to those cave paintings. They didn't have to compete with digital images or soft images or images that were not on a surface.
Yeah, but they had to compete with what they were painting, which were the animals in front of them.
Yeah.
And I think that, the basic issue of survival, but I think the basic issue at Lascaux is pretty much or in the basic issue of today, whether it be digital film or relatively conventional art making, it's about observation. What you see at Lascaux is what the artists or the people who are making those images saw. And they recorded those images, they interpreted their observation, and they used them for whatever purpose we don't really know. But they were observing what they were recording or putting down on the walls.
Do you see?
And I think it's the observation that's the most important.
So the way in which that art, that observation is expressed. I mean, in their case, it was the ochre sort of sketching horse and
charcoal
and on a cave wall, and then came canvas, and then you came and moved into aluminum and copper, and then broke right out of the rectangular canvas.
Yeah, and carbon fiber.
Carbon fiber. I want to talk about that, but now we're into this. As you say, these digital images are all around. At the most fundamental level, does it matter whether visual art is on a tangible surface, as you say, or is digital? Does it matter? Is it important to the fundamental function or impact of art?
No, I don't. I really don't think it is. I think what you hinted at is that it's the power, and going back to Lascaux, it's the power of the image that's created one way or the other. So you experience the image, whether you experience it on a screen or whether you experience it by having it transmitted to you and then you print it out. I mean, it's still finally the image that you have to absorb. That you absorb it a little differently if it's physical, I like better, that you can touch it, that it has tactile qualities. One of the problems with digital art is that the surface, ironically, is like what I was accused of doing before, which is making art that's too flat.
By definition.
Yes. The digital art's flatter than any art I ever made.
And you were pretty flat. You got about as flat as it could possibly be for the time. Sort of big expanses of black with just pinstripes and almost, or maybe literally, just house paint on there. This was not about texture.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was. Texture was an important part. I mean, they were a little bit more physical than they've been described because the paint did build up and it was very cheap black enamel paint and it had a real surface quality.
So do you think, I mean, thinking of the edge of art, looking forward here, will paint or something else on a surface, something tactile, always be around as an important vehicle for expression? Is that going to be antiquated? Will people look back on that one day in digital eras? That'll be as antiquated as, charcoal on a cave wall?
Well, I think, it's entirely possible that digital art will produce texture. I remember when they first had a reproduction, say, of Van Gogh or Monet or something like that, and then the people came up with a silkscreen technique to produce the texture, underlying texture, and then they printed the screen over the texture that they put down first, and everybody said that was more real than the real paintings, including, by the way, Sidney Janis, who said that a reproduction that was being reproduced by the Whitney was as good as the real thing.
As good as the real thing, and that was fine.
And it was cheaper, too.
So, but when you say you think digital art will have more texture, that is interesting. I mean, I know you're very into carbon
fiber. Well, there's no reason why it can't. And, I mean, there's no reason why digital art can't be transferred to any surface or, any forms. I mean, I know people are going to go bananas over the virtual rendering of imagery. But that's still basically on a screen, and it's actually on a flat screen.
When you say virtual rendering, you mean taking maybe someone's oil and canvas piece and just showing it in digital form?
No, just their own imagery. I mean, the game imagery. which is so popular, is very three-dimensional, and they make it more and more. I mean, you can, you know, you can machine gun somebody or hit the ball out of the park in a completely visually three-dimensional element.
Think about that future. Area. Does it just mean 3D, that texture you're talking about, digital 3D, or are you imagining something beyond that?
Well, if I could imagine it, I'd tell you right now. But I mean, but anything is possible. I mean, I don't want to, I wouldn't rule anything out, yes.
I mean, pretty soon you're into some Woody Allen era of art. I don't know where you step into the Artmetron and you're experiencing texture, even though, well, I don't know if 3D is really texture.
There, yes. Yeah, but I think that we do live in a physical and in a real world in a certain sense. And while there are many illusionistic, actually one way to look at digital art and the virtual art is that it's just another version of illusionism. And I don't want to, you know, devastate the listeners, but in my time anyway, the battle has always been between illusionism and literalism. And an editor once said to me, my readers don't read that.
Meaning?
That nobody really cares that much and wants to get into the kind of discussions that you get into when you talk about literalism and illusionism, whether the literalism of a Don Judd box is in fact separate from an illusionistic experience of, for example, a painting of the box.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Frank Stella this hour, the celebrated American painter, printmaker, sculptor, out of the abstract era, talking about art and artists and eras in art, maybe the edge of art. Frank Stella was there early and young in the 1960s with his minimalist abstract paintings, and then right on through a very rich career. He's right in the heart of things even now. In December, he was on the Colbert Report. Stephen Colbert asked Frank Stella to comment on two paintings he had displayed on the set. The first was one of Stella's own works, a large minimalist painting made up of concentric parallelograms, a conceptual portrait of his friend Carl Andre. The second was a cheesy, computer-generated painting of Colbert himself in various self-important poses you can imagine. Here's the exchange.
That is an image of your art, Carl Andre, a portrait. Is that a good likeness of him?
Well, I really think it is, but, you know, you have to look for it, though. You didn't look hard enough
to find it. Is there any chance that this is a nude of him? Should I be blurring out any part of this right now?
I think you found it, maybe. But
that lower
is it
corner
in the
right there. Now, what about my... Is this art?
Yes.
It is art?
Yes. I'll declare it to be art to make you happy.
You can declare this to be art?
Yes.
Is that a superpower you have? How, by looking at it, can you declare it to be art?
Well, I think it's what anybody can do. If you want to look at art, you can find it.
So now, have you made it art by calling it art?
Yes.
No excuses there on the Colbert Report from Frank Stella. Frank, did you enjoy that exchange?
Yes, yeah. You know, it's terrific there. And as much as the show is interesting... the warm-up before the show, there really is a lot of fun. These guys are pretty terrific.
A lot of hooting and hollering.
Right. Yeah, they're very sharp, and they're really into it. It's wonderful.
But here you are. I mean, I guess you were 74 then, but it means you've spent most of your lifetime responding, no doubt, to popular culture questions about the abstract and abstraction. I mean, there, he's looking at your parallelograms and wants to know if it's a good likeness of Carl, if he's nude or not. Are you tired of that? Did you tire of it a long time ago?
Yes, but, you know, I mean, I really only feel bad about one thing about something like that, is that I missed the chance when he introduced me as the father of minimalism to find out who the mother of minimalism was.
And what about the arc of your own work? I mean, I look back to those very minimalist triangles and squares and very flat canvases. and then, you know, sort of push it forward. And we have a small album of your work at our website, onpointradio.org, for listeners who haven't followed it. But check it out. I mean, it gets, you get, over time,
yeah, it does
much
seem to get complicated, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and I much think richer in color and sort of flamboyant kind of wild displays of color and form.
But I think that it's still, in a certain sense, really the same. Essentially, it's a problem about structure and about geometry. And, you know, we mentioned the digital age and everything, mm-hmm. and I'm working now almost all the time with what amounts to become quite popular now, three-dimensional printing. So in that case, you make the forms... You can make the forms on the computer, mm-hmm. and then you can have them fabricated because it's based on the idea of the CT scan. So everything is in a line that can be one line on top of another.
So it's literally laying down material layer by layer by layer until you're what your
yeah,
computer.
Until you have what you want, yeah.
It's actually physically there before
you. The image that you had on the computer, mm-hmm. yeah.
And it's 3D. Yeah. We're talking about it's a sculptural image in effect.
Yes, but I mean, I paint it, and it's the issue is, you know, what's the difference if it's a three-dimensional image or it's you know, the flat painting is a three-dimensional object actually anyway, and the question is that what you do on the surface, if you imagine a lot of shapes or lines drawn on a flat surface, or you imagine this kind of spherical sculptural form, if you were to follow it. The edge of it with your finger, mm-hmm. You could create a kind of drawing that would look very much like the conventional drawing of an abstract painting.
So do you design sculpture now on the computer and then print it out, I don't know, a model of it and have assistants create it at full size? Is that?
Well, I do that. We do work on the computer, and I have people who help me on the computer, Veronica and Egal, who are very mm-hmm. handy. Mm-hmm. And we make images on the computer, and then those images, the geometry of those images can be handled as a tape by a manufacturer. This, in this particular case, is in Belgium, and he has one of the largest machines for making putting these kind of objects together. And then they build the object, and then they send it back to us to work on.
Take us all the way back, if you would. You talked years ago and famously at Harvard in the Norton Lectures there about Caravaggio, someone you've paid a lot of attention to. It's not just Jackson Pollock and Jasper Johns, but all the way back mm-hmm. to the Renaissance or, you know, after the High Renaissance there. When you talked about how, and I want to bring this forward to artists to today, but to just to help us see how the edge moves. You talked about, you know, Caravaggio sitting there with his problem, coming after Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo and Raphael, and now here he is, a great painter. But what does he do that these greats didn't do? Describe that challenge and how he confronted it, if you would.
Well, there's a lot of, I mean, actually, in some ways, it's controversial, I suppose. But really, what Caravaggio did is what somehow all really interesting things happen to be. They fuse opposites. He both flattened painting and projected it at the same time. Berenson was bitterly disappointed in Caravaggio's lack of space because there was no perspective basically behind the figures, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of darkness, and it was all done with light and shade.
Unlike the Renaissance ones before him with deep, deep
with
fields of depth
space.
Behind.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. He even went so far as to call Caravaggio academic. But anyway, that was one of the problems. Yet at the same time, by the use of light and the chiaroscuro and the, Caravaggio was able to make the images project forward in a way so that it's almost a cliche now, but there was a sense in which they were in the viewer's space. So at
which
the
makes
same
intimacy,
time,
tremendous intimacy.
Well, it may be intimacy, but you could also call it tremendous aggression.
Okay.
He really brought it forward, yes. The entombment, for example, or the deposition. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. the bodies are coming at you.
I happen to love that about Caravaggio. Sure, he doesn't have you in those enormous kind of market or temple spaces of some of the earlier ones. But they're talk about the possibility of digital going 3D and textural. And he's taken canvas and brought it kind of out into your lap.
Yeah, I mean, as far as what's been done digitally so far, I mean, it has a long way to go. All I'm saying is I'm not going to say that the possibilities are nil.
So when you were sitting there in the late 1950s as a very young man, and you're looking at the abstract expressionists who had come before you, and they were very, very prominent. Let's take Jackson Pollock. I mean, here you are in a way with a kind of similar challenge. What do you do if you're going to work in the abstract? And from what I read, you were just presuming that you would. How do you follow that kind of explosive energy of Jackson Pollock? Did you think about that as a technical challenge, an artistic challenge? How did you think about it specifically in that way?
No, in a certain sense, it was a given. So, you know, I stayed focused on what I was really interested in and what I was able to do at the time. And at the time, I was able to make paintings that I did like and were essentially abstract paintings, but they were also essentially landscape-derived. And all that happened was in painting the bands, horizontal bands will inevitably give you a landscape feeling. But if you were to take the bands and mm-hmm. follow the shape of the canvas mm-hmm. so that they went around the corners, all of a sudden the landscape element, in a way, disappears. And in a way, you have a kind of abstract image or a surface that, you know, kind of speaks for itself.
So you say landscape derived, but this is a long way from Bierstadt or, you know, Hudson Valley School. I mean, you're talking about the kind of visual experience.
Well, that's great painting, mm-hmm. but still... the landscape, the notion of the landscape, and there are, of course, the figures in the landscape. But still, landscape painting is basically different from the figurative painting that was done, for the most part, for the church and to tell stories. And the landscape painting was in itself a degree of abstraction compared with the painting directly before it. To leave the people out of the landscape or to reduce them to such a small size was already a step in a different direction.
You've said somewhere along the way, in a long life of commenting and talking about art, that for abstract art, the real challenge was this lack of the human figure. Now, of course, there, you know, your parallelograms were a reference. You titled them anyway to Carl Andre. But still, what did you mean there? And has that been surmounted, or did that sink it?
Well, I don't think you sink anything, but I think that you can move along. Things do change, and the notion of how things should be changes. But I think that the body, that's a problem because it's a problem on two levels. But on one level, the mechanics and the physicality of the body and the gestures that the body is able to make and mm-hmm. represent, mm-hmm. it's hard to do anything in a certain sense more complicated or more arresting or more image, or more interesting than the movement and shape of the body. But on the other hand, the body also addresses the viewer in a way in which the viewer feels comfortable mm-hmm. because he can, in a way, see himself.
That's me. Right.
He recognizes his own body mm-hmm. or he can feel his own body in the painting. In a landscape painting, for example, often people talk about the awe of the landscape painting or being lost in it. Mm-hmm. You know, already you're beginning to feel a sense of the loss of the body, of particularly of the viewer. He feels overwhelmed by what's in front of him.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's the highly abstract form of that
there
landscape.
He feels lost or confounded, yes.
straight up, maybe. Frank Stella is with us, great American painter, printmaker, sculptor. Frank, we've got a lot of listeners lining up to talk with you, and I want to begin to turn to them, if I may. Frank Stella joins us today from New York. We've got Dustin calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Dustin, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air with Frank Stella.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Stella. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to hear Frank Stella talk about old masters and the history of painting, and that kind of leads me to a thought I had that I'd like to hear his opinion about, and that's that I think with abstract expressionism, formalism, minimalism, that there began a hyper-intellectualism of art, and I think that's only continued to where now a lot of cultural theory, French theory, influences, artist training, even in small state schools like I went to, but certainly in the big elite colleges,
mm-hmm.
You know, Yale, Art Institute of Chicago, and so forth. And I feel like it's kind of diluted art's impact on culture. It's this highly specialized, esoteric, again, highly intellectualized knowledge.
You're not going to get me to disagree with you. There's no chance.
I'm sorry?
You're not going to get me to disagree with you. I think it's a real problem.
Why do you think that there's any remedy? I mean, I do feel like, you know, art, I mean, if you walked out on the street and asked, you know, asked any 10 people to name a living contemporary artist, you know, fairly famous contemporary artist, I think you might have trouble finding someone, certainly outside of New York City or certain parts of New York City. And
we know that everyone's going to say Andy Warhol, and it's going to pretty much end there. But that's for a lot of other reasons. But the problem with criticism is that the criticism has to adapt to the art that's presented to it. But the way it adapts is to turn in, or has adapted, at least in my lifetime, has to turn in on itself. And, you know, I feel a certain amount of blame, actually, because one of the things that I think was in the back of my mind with the paintings that I was making, particularly the black paintings and the aluminum paintings like that, was it was a way to keep the critics' mouth shut.
Because they wouldn't know what to say? They'd be dumbfounded or what?
But not dumbfounded, but they wouldn't have anything really relevant to make in the terms of traditional art criticism.
So was your strategy in getting started in the art world part of the problem that Dustin's describing here?
I think indirectly I probably am part of the problem, yes. But it shouldn't have been. I mean, it doesn't have to be.
Have you worked your way out of that, do you think, at this point, Frank, if that was the case?
Well, it depends on, you know, on whom you ask. I mean, some of the critics would say, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And when Working Space first came out, a lot of people said, yeah, what do we need to go on a tour with Frank Stella to see paintings in Rome and Vienna and Munich? It's just an art tour. But I didn't charge them anything for it.
Dustin, I appreciate your call, and I hope you stick with it. Maybe you'll be the one that brings it out to all. Colette in Worcester, Massachusetts. Colette, you're on the air with Frank Stella.
Hi, I'm glad you let me ask Frank Stella a question. I just want to say I really admire him. I remember when one of his pieces came to the Seattle airport when I was a child, and just really love what he does. And looking at a lot of abstract art now, I'm an artist myself. I do ceramics. And my ceramics is very unusual in the sense that what I do on the green work then becomes a part of the piece, you know, 3 months later after it goes through Raku firing. Mm-hmm. And so the smoke and everything kind of makes an image. And I'm getting odd images like the Osama bin Laden is in one of my images, and I've got Confucius comes up, and, you know, various religious things come up, and so the image changes. And I am asking him, I'd like to know if when he conceives of an idea, does he seriously stick with that idea all the way through till it's finished, or does he allow it to adapt as the art itself adapts?
Evolution as it comes to life. Thanks, Colette. What do you say, Frank? We've got half a minute
before
the break.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I've tried a lot of ceramics, and I've been immensely unsuccessful working with ceramic. And I do love it, actually. It's a lot of fun, and what she's describing sounds really interesting to me.
Does your art change in the process of its creation?
Yes, it does. But it doesn't change very radically because I'm so committed to the structure. Once I started to convince myself that I wanted to build the painting that I was going to work on, I was kind of stuck with what I built.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with Frank Stella, the celebrated American painter, printmaker, sculptor out of the abstract era, about art and artists and eras in art, the edge of art, if you will. Frank Stella joins us today from New York, and it's great to have him with us. Frank, we've got a lot of response to you online as well. Here's one from Ken. He says, when I was an American boy living in Holland in the late 60s, my father used to take me to the Dutch Grand Prix in the seaside resort of Zandvoort. Back in school, during classes, I would draw and redraw the outline of the racetrack. Imagine my delight, Ken writes for you, Frank, 2 decades later, to come across the same shape in a Frank Stella piece at MoMA. I've loved Mr. Stella's work ever since. That sounds like an obsession you might relate to, Frank.
I lost the point of the question, but I'll get right back to it. But Zandvoort brings back really actually some kind of sad memory, but also typical kind of memory. In racing, in one particular race when Mario Andretti was racing for the Formula One Championship, his co-driver mm-hmm. was a Swedish driver, Ronnie Peterson. And you could see during the course of the race, they have what they call team orders. And Mario was leading, and you could see Ronnie behind him, and his brake lights were on almost the whole last 2 laps.
Mm.
Just reminded me of that.
Well, to stick with racing for a moment, let me come back to Ken's point, and then we'll go to racing. But he was fascinated as a child by the outline of the racetrack itself, and then thought he saw that in some of your own work later, that outline of the Zandvoort track.
Well, I made a whole series of works based on the tracks and the circuits, as they like to say, inspired by the fact, by the form and the mm-hmm. outline of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
But the real issue is not actually the pure geometry of the track. It's how the geometry of the track relates to how the car has to perform on the track.
Talk about
and the
jumping.
Challenge that is to the driver.
Sure.
And the engineers.
I mean, talk about jumping off the flat surface. You famously years ago painted, BMW used to have its cars painted by prominent artists, you among them, with a very famous painting of a BMW. But in real life, you are kind of a speed demon yourself. I think you've owned Ferraris over the year and driven them at some tremendous high speeds and really spent no small amount of time in the company of race car drivers.
Well, no small amount of time in jail. But I mean, the real point is that
speeding.
Driving is very hard, and driving fast on the road is not a good idea, especially by me. But at the track, you can practice. And it's a great form. It's a great hobby if you can afford it to have driving lessons. And it makes you drive better, actually.
Here's Scott Daltonic, who speaks to some of your work in the 90s, I think. He says, I love his Moby Dick work. And he asks, is that something you'll keep going back to, or is that something he feels that you feel that you've completed your work on, Frank? Remind us of your Moby Dick work, when it was, what it inspired, and are you still in that?
Well, it was so big. I mean, I think it's well over 300 works or mm-hmm. something like that. And I was interested in Moby Dick, and you know, just really the idea is pretty straightforward. Abstraction. You would say, well, it doesn't really have any narrative content. It can't tell a story in the way that, say, a representational painting or mm-hmm. even in the way that a landscape painting. It tells you the story of the area and everything about that. So there's that narrative impulse which seems to be missing from abstraction. But I didn't feel that was really unapproachable. I mean, I felt that I could work in, as you said, a complicated way. You could make shapes and make the shapes in a certain sense relate to each other, almost create action and talk to each other. And I got involved in that with a Moby Dick piece that I made, and I titled it after Moby Dick. And mm-hmm. then I was talking with my son, and I, it all started with the beluga whales at the Brooklyn Aquarium. And the way they were moving and everything, the notion of movement and the notion of form mm-hmm. brought me back to Moby Dick, and I started thinking about it. But I don't want to go too long. But essentially, I said, but the problem with Moby Dick is, I mean, there are 135 chapters. I mean, where am I going to come up with that kind of imagery? And my son said to me, well, you don't have to do them all. And I was so infuriated that I just, started digging in and worked for the next 5 or 6 years trying to come up with 135 images that would make sense.
And take some of the drama of Melville right into your work. Do you see yourself as having started out with this presumption that abstraction was the way of the future? Have you worked your way back out of it in some sense?
Well, I think the work is as abstract as it can possibly be. I mean, the whole argument in working space, I guess, is that, and the whole argument about abstraction essentially is that, it's just beginning. So there's it's not conceivable to me to work your way out of abstraction. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is conceivable to me to expand the possibilities of abstraction and what it can do.
Let's go to our listeners. Bill in Madison, Connecticut. Bill, you're on the air with Frank Stella.
Hi, Frank. It's great to meet you abstractly here. As a teenager, I enjoyed one of your paintings on the wall in a house I used to babysit, which was a thrill. And this whole idea of abstract, concrete, virtual, real is interesting because, to me, I went on to become a yacht designer. And for us, we've used 3D tools, originally 3D, mm-hmm. as in paper and battens and splines and ducts. But everything was about getting to a real thing, a concrete result, an actual vessel. Mm-hmm. I explored some sculpture. I did some sculptures as a kid out of Kevlar and epoxy and wood, and I would actually design them. It was an interesting process because I'd go through this abstract to concrete sort of tension the entire time, because to me a sculpture is an exploring an abstract form, and so that was very much tactile, which meant pieces of cardboard and paper. And then from that, then I would draw them, and I would actually loft it and produce a blueprint. And then I would build it again. So then it goes abstract, mm-hmm. it goes to 2D, it goes back in, and it gets built again. It becomes a real thing. And in the end, the entire thing is an abstraction because it's not an actual functioning thing, but it is a concrete object. There's this layering. And then art itself is always abstract because ultimately it's saying something at an abstract level about something that we want to say. I find that tension interesting, and the idea of reproductions of a reproduction of a Van Gogh or whoever, and versus the actual painting, the experience of having a real Stella in the room versus looking at it in a book, the experience of a screen making a sculpture and then having it cut with a 3-5-axis router rather than cutting it with a chisel.
Frank, does that sound familiar to you, that process?
Yeah, he's talking about all the things mm-hmm. we do, and most mm-hmm. of the designers that I've worked with come from the shipbuilding industry. And if you're building, he knows better than I, that if you have a fabricating problem and you have compound curves and things like that, you pretty much have to go to the shipbuilders.
Hey, and Bill, and what were you looking for in all that work? Were you looking for a sculpture to create a sensation, to transmit an idea? What, Bill?
Well, that's the thing. It's interesting. Really, for me, it was about the materials and the visual impact of materials that we were using for technical reasons and how this stuff really looked neat. And there's a liberating – when you're focused on the technical and the developing mm-hmm. things that have to function for working, then that's a constraining an envelope. But the materials are fascinating. And so for me at the time – this was in the early 80s – late 80s? I forget. I'm losing track. It was exciting.
Well, I think he has, a really good point. I have Frank? In my studio a Formula One car. It doesn't have the engine, but it's the complete body, and it raced. So it came off the track, and it sits in my studio.
What does it do for you?
It does actually something quite interesting because it's very hard to get someone to look at my work when they can look at the Ferrari race car on the floor. So it's a really good gauge of what's in the background, which happens to be my work.
Keep the challenger right there in the room. Mary in Melrose, Massachusetts, talking about Frank Stella territory. Mary, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. And Frank, it's a pleasure. You're a rock star in my world. I grew up in Melrose. My father knew your father. He was a physician there, and he used to tell a story. I changed my major from pre-med to art, and I thought they'd be really upset. My father encouraged me because he said, yeah, my friend, Stella, he sent his son to Princeton, and now he's hanging out with some hobos down there in Greenwich Village, but look at him now. And I don't know. Your life has been an inspiration to me and sort of gave me the courage to pursue something that can be intimidating at times. And actually, I'm driving around right now in the back of my car is a painting that's just recently been rejected from a show, but it was a representational figurative piece, and my abstract piece got into the show. So I'm half celebrating and half, why did this get in?
Well, I think
abstraction lives.
Well, I mean, it's a problem. The Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, very early on, bought a painting of mine that was really a large painting, 10 by 50 feet. And I came home to visit my mother, and she was having an exhibition actually in the bank, and with a group of other artists, mostly women artists, from the Rockport area. And they had their paintings on a very large wall. And it was an exhibition, and some of the paintings were for sale, and everyone was quite happy and proud showing their work and everything. And I was there talking with my mother and walking around. And then something, you know, didn't feel right to me. I was looking at all these paintings on the wall. And then the wall, I realized, was a false wall. So I walked to the end of it, and I looked around behind the wall, and this wall had been constructed in front of my painting. And so my mother's painting and her friends from Rockport were being exhibited in front of my own painting at the Federal Reserve Bank.
The beat goes on. Speaking of buying paintings, I don't know if you pay attention to this anymore, but just in the last few days, a couple of weeks, we've had a big Sotheby's sale of contemporary art. And, you know, a kind of a sale where there was one, Jeff Koons' Pink Panther, sold for $15 million. And this was considered, oh, my gosh, almost a failure. Some really high price, you know, Andy Warhol, $18 million, Lucio Fontana, little paintings, $5.5 million. What about the price of art? Do you pay attention to that? What's paid for what?
Well, I don't have much choice.
It's your livelihood.
When I don't pay attention, people are sure to tell me how well or not so well my paintings did at auction.
What do you think of those big, what look to most people like very, very large numbers you can get into these days?
I think it's, you know, it's pretty much an illusion because the art world is very big. There are very many artists, and it's a complicated community. And you know, you have institutions, you have galleries, you have dealers, and you have auction houses and collectors, and they're all part of the same thing.
But does the gravity of all that money change art? Does it? You know, does it in a good way, a bad way at all?
Actually, I think it has almost no effect whatsoever. I mean, because in the end, for the artists, they all, if they're serious, they all worry about what they're doing. And in the end, they want to make something. Quality is still important. How beautiful it is still important. And that's and how it looks. You have to remember the audience for the artist. He is the audience. I mean, it has to look good to the artist himself before he's even willing to show it to somebody else.
Let's go to Clark in Burlington, Vermont. Clark, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Frank Stella.
Hi, guys. I recently founded a free online art school called publicartschool.com, and I'm kind of in the place to, like, teach the whole world whatever I think is important to teach about art. And Mr. Stella, you have been a huge influence on my work, and I just want to ask you, what do you think is important to teach the next generation?
Great. Frank?
Well, you know, that's a leading question, and you know, it just makes me want to be facetious, I guess, you know. But in the end, they always said, you know, do what you want to do. And I think the really important thing is to be encouraging, to be involving, to provide opportunity, and to limit the constraints as much as you can. And that's what it is for the art educator. I mean, and to keep alive the enthusiasm and the validity of the past.
I got a couple of big questions here from online from Russ. He says, well, here's one. Do you believe that all artists, including songwriters, filmmakers, authors, as well as visual artists, have the same motivations when they desire to communicate to people? Or is there something special that a visual artist is trying to express or do?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's special, but I think it's compartmentalized because I can't hear anything. So the songwriter is wasting his time communicating with me.
What do you mean you can't hear anything? You don't have a musical ear? You're clearly not deaf.
No, that's a very polite way of putting it.
I see. Okay.
So it's tough. I mean, it's tough to say. I think, though, that the impulse is the same. The impulse is to make, again, as I say, it begins at home. The impulse is to make something that you care about, and then if you believe it enough or you or like it enough, you hope that it can be, you can communicate it or it's worth communicating.
And one more from Russ. He says, what do you think, this is for you, Frank Stella, what do you think about the idea of art for art's sake? Do you think that art must have a message? Does it bother you if art is an elitist activity?
It doesn't bother me that it's an elitist activity. I mean, I don't know what there are lots of I can't come up with it. But there's outsider art, and then there's regular art. There's abstract art. There's representational art. It is true. There's all kinds of art, and as far as I'm concerned, it all counts. I don't know how much time there is. A quick story: Picasso. Picasso is with friends. They're going through a flea market, and he stops, and he goes over, and he picks up a painting, and then he takes a few francs out of his pocket, and he buys it. And his friends look at him and say, what are you going to do with that? What is that? And he said, what about if I don't love this poor painting, who will? And so the level of involvement and attraction is there at every level.
Even Picasso.
So it's all art. It all counts.
Feeling for that lonely little piece in the market. Frank Stella, it's been wonderful to spend this hour with you. We're grateful to you for taking the time to be with us. You're up here to speak at Boston University recently, and everybody enjoyed that. We thought it'd be great to catch up with you, and it's been great. Thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you.
The great Frank Stella, who was awarded the National Medal of Arts by President Obama in 2009, His irregular polygons work from the 60s on display at the Toledo, Ohio Museum of Art, also showing at the National Gallery in Berlin and starting in June at the Phillips Collection in Washington. Frank, Stella, listeners, thanks for joining us today. You can see some of Frank's work at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.